welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Tim Dennis is out dealing with COVID, folks, so make sure that you keep Tim in your thoughts and prayers. Today we have an interesting aspect of the show we're going to discuss, the JFK assassination dissected, an analysis by forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht. He's back with us since President Kennedy's assassination in 1963 in Dallas, Texas. Medical examiner and lawyer Dr. Cyril Wecht has initially inclined to accept the official theory that one person alone was responsible for this crime. But as Dr. Wecht delved into the evidence with boundless curiosity and unprecedented access, he came to understand that America had instead suffered a coup d'etat at the hands of a rogue element within our own government. Nobody else has Dr. Wecht's up-close and personal experience in uncovering the facts behind this assassination. And now he's sharing it with the world in a brand new book co-authored by investigative journalist Donna Kaufman. This comprehensive book reveals Wecht's analysis of the case's forensic and medical evidence. And with his keen eye and sharp tongue, Wecht wields his scalpel on JFK's dubious autopsy report, the inept Warren Commission report, and the mishandling of crucial materials, all of the key players and the media malpractice that has allowed the truth to remain hidden for nearly six decades. We have a link for the book in today's program guide. Dr. Wecht, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. A pleasure to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Let's dive right into this. Getting into this, as it said, you were one to believe the original claims of this case. How quickly after that Warren report and the official claims did you really start to look in and dissect this case?
Well, it wasn't long. The assassination, November 22nd, 1963, and just a couple of years later, when I was assistant district attorney, medical legal advisor, the director of the laboratory, who had become a good friend of mine, invited me to give a talk at the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. He was one of the program chairs for that meeting, which was to take place in February 1965. And I went to our big library here in Pittsburgh, got the 26 volumes, finally found the autopsy report, and began to look into it. And the more I studied it, the more I realized how inept, how incompetent it was. That ineptitude, incompetence, could be attributed directly to, as I came to learn, the fact that the two naval pathologists who did the autopsy, Humes and Boswell by name, at Bethesda Naval Hospital that evening on Friday, November 22nd, had never done a gunshot wound autopsy in their entire careers. Multiple gunshot wounds, differentiation of entrance and exit to be made, angle, range, trajectory, sequence, correlation then with the wounds in Governor John Connally, an extremely formidable task that would take a two or three team of top-notch forensic pathologists working together to put it together satisfactorily. And so here you have, in this great, marvelous country of ours, with all of the top forensic pathologists right there within the Washington, D.C. area, 1 hour drive or flying time, as well as career military forensic pathologists right there on the grounds of the Walter Reed Hospital at what used to be called the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, all of these people completely, deliberately ignored. So the more I got into it, and I realized then, when I matched up with the doctors at Parkland Hospital, these 18 different surgeons working on the president talked about in terms of what they saw, the defects in the rear of the skull, the occipital region, the cerebellar tissue, that part of the brain which is located behind and below the cerebral hemispheres, being damaged extensively. And yet the pathologist that night doing the autopsy said that those areas were intact. So who do you believe? Those good old Texas boys who had examined hundreds and hundreds of cases over the years, or these two incompetents doing the work under the supervision and guidance of the four-star admirals and generals sitting there in the autopsy room? And then later on, when I discovered the fact that the brain was missing, that the brain had never been dissected and studied. It had been set aside properly for 2 weeks, fixed in formalin to get a harder consistency, and then you go back and you slice it like a hard-boiled egg, which is what is done. They went back and they never dissected the brain. The brain was never examined, and the brain remains unaccounted for as we talk here today, 58 years later. And then you get into the single bullet theory, which they came up with because they had a seemingly impossible physical temporal incongruity between the test firing time of the Maniker Carcano, the alleged murder weapon, a non-automatic bolt action piece of junk weapon. Every long gun expert has told me that. Timing with the Zapruder film, the film that was made by a gentleman named Zapruder, standing there at Dealey Plaza up by the grassy knoll. And that film studied showed that Connolly was struck 1.5 seconds after Kennedy was hit, and it took the best marksman that the government could come up with, 2.3 seconds from shot to shot. And that gave birth to the single bullet theory, which they said was a magic bullet, Commission Exhibit 399, that broke, that made seven wounds in two men, destroyed 4 inches of Connolly's right fifth rib, caused a comminuted, fragmented fracture of the distal end of the radius, one of the two large bones from the elbow to the wrist. And remember, Connolly, 6'4", big bone Texan. You're not talking about a dainty little 90-pound woman here. That bullet emerged near pristine, a weight loss of only 1.5%, completely intact, a slight crimping at the base, the nose, the cone of this copper-jacketed lead core bullet, completely intact. And then when you trace its trajectory coming out of Kennedy's neck, it makes horizontal and vertical gyrations of multiple inches to come over to the right, slam into Connolly behind his right armpit, go down through the chest, emerge below nipple level. Connolly holding his Texan right Stetson hat at the shoulder level, the bullet emerges, hooks up and around a dozen inches, goes into the back of his wrist, shatters the radius, as I've said, and then proceeds into the left thigh, and somehow miraculously fell out without being seen by anybody else. A maintenance man at Parkland Hospital trying to get to the men's room, finding the corridor blocked, move the stretchers, and lo and behold, there was this bullet. Commission Exhibit 399, the hero of the single bullet theory, labeled a long time ago by the critics as the magic bullet theory. So that tells you about this incredible falsehood, the ongoing conspiracy promulgated by top-level people in this country, but not the Russians or the Chinese or the Cubans. We have met the enemy, and he is us. Some active or recently retired CIA top military people, I don't know exactly who, and I don't know how many. I bet you that there weren't more, 4, 5, 6 people who got together and said, this is what we have to do. We can't sit back and let 5 more years of John Kennedy, followed by 8 years of Bobby Kennedy. They saw America going to hell in a basket. They did not like it at all. Kennedy had vowed to get out of Vietnam. And he was pushing for all kinds of changes, a warming of the Cold War with Russia, and most importantly, following the Bay of Pigs debacle in Cuba, he said that he was going to destroy the CIA. He had a piece of paper sitting with Senator Mike Mansfield, majority leader at that time, tore it up into pieces and said, this is what I intend to do to the CIA. So there you have it. It was coup d'etat in America.
Well, Dr. Wecht, why not just destroy the credibility of the president, who was on drugs, dealing with Addison's disease, and cheating on his wife with Marilyn Monroe and other people? I mean, it seems like instead of murdering him, they could have taken him out other ways. Or did they need a murder? Well, did they need something to unify the United States and stand behind?
Yeah. Well, see, the problem with that is that it's going to take a long time and it can't be guaranteed to be successful. And you're thinking, you see, as a sane, rational, decent human being, you might, you know, say, well, how can I accomplish something without engaging in something as horrendous as brutal murder in a large city in broad daylight? Yes, a fascinating observation. You're right. All those things are correct. He was a womanizer. He had the affair with Marilyn Monroe. You know, and I don't know that he was on drugs, I mean, somewhat, but the Addison's disease, adrenal insufficiency, you're right. Those are things are known. And interestingly, the news media knew those things too, and they never talked about it. And the news media had continued in a second conspiratorial cover-up in failing to report all the things that I've talked about. And many things we don't have time to get into, including the analysis of the acoustics evidence from Dealey Plaza that day, which was transmitted inadvertently by a police officer on a motorcycle, and that was studied by the top acoustics experts in the country, in Cambridge and New York City, and determined that shots were indeed fired from the rear and from the front. And the news media has ignored that and refuses to publish anything at all of a critical nature. I don't care who writes what book and what they have to say and what scientific analysis is out there. That's the way it's going to be. So I cover all these things in my book, the JFK autopsy, dissection of the JFK autopsy, in a clear fashion, not too heavily tendentious in a scientific way as to be overwhelming, and a lot of good background information, including my private meetings with Marina Oswald, Oswald's widow, and Georgi Morinchild, this white Russian emigre, Texas oil man, who befriended Oswald and took him under his wing, and so on.
Do you believe, can I ask really quickly, Dr. White, do you believe that Oswald was truly a patsy? Did he have a hand in any of this assassination, or was he the easy guy to hang it on?
I don't want to get bogged down in making this appear to be a posthumous, retroactive exculpation, exoneration of Lee Harvey Oswald, who was not a nice person. But based upon the bullet wound in the president's back and its emergence at an upward angle of 1.5 degrees from the throat, the angle, the trajectory, doesn't fit in with Oswald's position in the sixth floor window. So I tend to believe that he indeed was a patsy, as all set up going back to his 2.5 years in Russia. Before that, his honorable discharge from the Marine Corps, based upon a fictitious story of injury to his mother, illness of his mother, and so on. I think Oswald, not to in any way paint him as a purely innocent person, but insofar as the actual shooting is concerned, I tend to believe that he was not a shooter.
How many shooters do you believe might have been involved in this with the actual evidence that you were able to see through the autopsy and the wounds that were created?
I believe there were two shooters. It's possible there could have been a third, but two shooters, one from the rear, maybe not from the Texas School Book Depository building, but from the Dell Tech building, which would line up better, and one from behind a picket fence on the grassy knoll. So two shooters. Could there have been a third one? I don't think so. We don't have any evidence of that. We do have a bullet that supposedly missed, but I think I'll stick with two shooters.
How did you discover the fact that Kennedy's brain was missing? And you know, there has to be some line of to follow for medical examiners. How can it just disappear?
I was the first non-government appointed, non-government related forensic pathologist given access to the autopsy materials in 1972. There was a cockamamie executive order that claimed all these materials, everything belonged to Jackie Kennedy in April of 65, an inventory then in October of 66. I saw when I was down there did not contain the box containing the brain and so on. How I got in was that cockamamie absurd executive order, the likes of which had never been promulgated previously or since, said that nobody could see these things for 75 years, with the exception that a recognized expert in the field of pathology with a serious historic purpose could apply. And finally, I got in. I was president of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, president of American College of Legal Medicine, coroner of Allegheny County, board-certified forensic pathologist, and so I applied, and after they jagged me around for a year, that's a long story, I finally got in. And that is when I discovered then that the brain was missing. Now, was I the first one to know this? Oh, no, many people. And this shows you the nature, the depth, the extent, the power of this conspiracy, that top-notch people, including, for example, someone who was my chief where I trained, Dr. Russell Fisher, at the medical examiner's office in Maryland, where I did my forensic pathology training. He was a member of the Ramsey-Clark panel in 68. So these people all came to know that the brain was missing. And nobody ever said that the brain was missing, that the brain had not been examined. Nobody. Can you imagine getting away with something like that? And I don't know when it would have been announced. Maybe it would have been covered up completely. I don't know. So I take credit for that. August 24, 1972, page one, New York Times, story by Fred Graham, President's Brain Missing. And as you and I talk here today, 58 years later, the anniversary just yesterday, that brain remains unaccounted for.
Can I ask you, Dr. Wecht, in what we do know from the Zapruder footage, from the autopsy reports, was it a kill shot? I was understanding he was still alive when he made it to the hospital. Could they be hiding the brain because he had survived and they ended his life?
No. The brain damage was extensive, as documented by the surgeons there at Parkland Hospital. Part of the brain had been blown away. No. Those injuries were incompatible with life. The bullet that entered his back and exited from the neck, that bullet might not have been fatal with proper immediate treatment. But the gunshot wound or wounds of the head indeed were fatal, and those injuries to the brain were irreversible and untreatable.
Do you believe that we're going to get an honest response from the government at the end of this 75-year kind of moratorium they have on releasing the information?
Well, I used to be optimistic maybe when I was younger, and I was hoping that one day. And when I see, though, after all these years, the way Trump finessed the release of all the records a year and a half ago or so, the way Biden finessed it, and now they keep talking about compromising national security by releasing information. I want somebody to explain that to me, how the Warren Commission report holding that one person, Lee Harvey Oswald, was responsible from beginning to end, how any documents about that would compromise our national security. So we'll see. In December 2020, Biden says that that's when he'll okay the release. We'll see what happens. This cover-up continues, and as I've already said, aided and abetted by the news media across the board, New York Times, all the way down. And if you can't break through with the government and you can't break through with the news media, then what the hell are you left with? What are you left with? Who's going to fight the battle? Who's going to open up the doors? And that, of course, is their problem, the government's problem. The moment you open up the door and involve a second person, you have, by definition of the criminal codes of every state and the federal government, a conspiracy. And that means then you have to conduct an investigation, and you'll see where those conspiratorial lines take you. And that is something that nobody wants to get into. To show that this was done by our government, by some people in our government, and it was covered up. This is heavy stuff.
Why do you think the government and the people are so complacent towards this when we're still trying World War II former guards of gulags and places where Jews were put to death? And these guys are in their high 90s. We're putting them to trial, but yet we don't want to release this information because there are still some people involved in the case that are alive. Shouldn't they stand trial? Shouldn't they be a part
of
this
case?
Well,
you bet your life. That's an excellent observation. I thank you for making it. They were still going after people. I saw something, too, where somebody in his mid-late 90s was being arrested and tried, I think it was in Germany or wherever, and what's coming out now with the gulags in Russia that Putin is trying to cover up. But here in America, you see, the people are complacent because this is part of America, a great part of America. They're not really involved in an intellectual, probative fashion about these important things in America. And then the younger generation or two behind me, what do they know? They know the American history book that they studied in high school and college says, reports this as an assassination taking place at Dallas Friday, November 22nd, 1963. Shooting Oswald, arrested, and so on. They don't get into it. They don't discuss any of this at all in detail, as far as I know. And why and how? But you know, this is the political naivete, the political ignorance. I don't mean to be insulting of a large mass of people in America. And yeah, you're right. We're still talking about things that were wrong in the Vietnam War and World War II, and yet this the most important murder of the history of the world, not only America. No other murder has gotten the attention that this did in that sense. No other murder was as important in determining the socio-political direction of this country and of the world. And you know, I don't get off into politics, Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, but suffice it to say that 13 years, 5 of John and 8 of Bobby Kennedy, that would have been a lifetime. And these people saw America going to hell in a basket, and they weren't going to sit back idly and let that happen. And they did what they had the power to do, and what they had done in Chile with Allende, in Guatemala with Arbenz, in Vietnam with the Ing Diem brothers, in Iran with Mossadegh, in Africa with Lumumba. They did what they felt was necessary to preserve the integrity of America. They did not like Kennedy's plan to warm up the Cold War with Russia, to pull out of Vietnam, to push for human rights and civil rights in America. They did not like that. And there was only one way to do it. They couldn't beat them at the polls. And getting back to observation you made about why didn't they just go after him for his moral conduct, I don't know how that would have sold. It didn't seem to sell bother people with Trump, who was nowhere near as nice a person and as beloved as Kennedy.
Right, but that was a different era, too. And I think because Kennedy was considered America's royalty, to have that carpet pulled out back then, when we certainly had the country had a much different modicum of respect for each other and our neighbors, it seems that would have undermined a lot. And looking at that aspect, I wonder if that's why we don't get the truth now, is because this is built upon such a shifting sandy base that if we reveal this, what other secrets are truly entwined in our history that will become revealed?
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. Does it necessarily end with the uncovering of the truth in the JFK assassination? What are the ramifications? What are the tentacles flow out from the head of this monster? That's a very good point. So, these people, including, the political titular heads at both sides of the political spectrum, Trump and Biden, and they're covering up. Why not just release it then? If there's nothing there, release it. What the hell are you afraid of?
When you were looking through the files yourself, was there much redacted, or was it completely unadulterated access to that information?
They did release some stuff, but there's a lot of information that has not been released, that has been redacted. And so one can only engage in conjecture as to what is there. Obviously, there's something of significance of a very disturbing nature, right? I think we can reasonably infer that without engaging in wild conjecture, that obviously there's something there that is very disturbing. Otherwise, it would have been released.
What was the most surprising aspect of the research that you did in this? Obviously, you know, finding out the brain was missing and that you kind of had some incompetent...
Yeah, well, I would say that's a single... Yeah, that was a single, if you want to, you know, prioritize, so to speak, I would place that as number one. The failure to examine the brain, the failure to have disclosed that information, the cover-up by foremost scientific people in this country in the field of forensic science and pathology and investigation and government levels not disclosing that, and the fact that the brain remains unaccounted for 58 years later, that by is number one. Number two would be the total ineptitude, incompetence, and experience of two pathologists doing this autopsy, our president, multiple gunshot wounds, like I've said before, okay? In no country of the world, you look it up, where a president, a king, a prime minister has been assassinated, where the autopsy has not been done by the top medical legal people in that country. You find one situation like that. And yet here, in our great, powerful, wonderful America, we see that happening, that autopsy being done by two guys who had never done a gunshot wound autopsy. That's number two on the hit parade. And number three, the background of Jack Ruby and Oswald Ruby just fortuitously coming down at the precise moment into the Dallas Public Safety Building when Oswald is being let out and conveniently eliminating him, because there's no damn way in the world that Oswald was going to go to trial and talk about all of these things, you can be sure.
It's fascinating that all these years later, 58 years later, there's still such a want and desire to understand this story.
Oh, there sure is. There sure is. And that's why I welcome the opportunity with somebody like you as an intelligent, knowledgeable host to talk about this and to, you know, mention my book. Not here to sell books, but I really think anybody with interest in the Kennedy assassination, in justice in America, in politics in America, in modern times, and what it means today, will find this book, JFK dissection of the JFK autopsy, extremely interesting. It's available through McFarland Publishing Company now, directly from McFarland, or it can be obtained by mail order from Amazon and Barnes & Noble for another few days or a week or so. You place the order, you get the book. I recommend it. It's interesting reading, and I think you're talking about a lot of things, including my meetings with Marina Oswald and DeMorenshield and the people who headed up the legal side of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, attorneys Dick Sprague and Bob Tannenbaum. You'll find some wonderful information there.
If I could ask one final question on this, is
yes, go ahead.
Reviewing these files, looking at the medical examiners, as you said, you pointed out the fallibility of these two guys that really had no business doing this. If you are running this incredible gambit, this coup d'etat to take out the president, do this, wouldn't it have made more sense to have the top people that you probably had control over to handle this, so that there wouldn't be these watermarks that are easy to examine and realize, why are these guys doing it instead of these guys?
Oh, but that's the point. That's the point, David. That's the point. You can't control the top forensic pathologists in New York City, Boston, Richmond, Philadelphia. There's no way you're going to control them. They would not have put their reputations, their life work at stake. Oh, no. They could not be controlled. But career naval pathologists could be controlled very easily. Four-star admirals and generals and government officials could control them. But that's why, that point you make, but your conclusion, I must respectfully disagree. These people were deliberately ignored because they could not be controlled.
That's fascinating. I wonder if they've ever taken it to the level of looking at these examiners' records financially and see if there's suddenly this gain in finances or...
I have no reason to believe that it was money involved with these people, military control and power. A government, there's a lot more effective than just some money. I know I never have thought about that, and I have no reason and no basis to say that. Well, I want to thank you so much. I want to extend my best wishes for Thanksgiving holiday to you and all your listeners. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss this with you, and I hope that my comments will open up the door and open up the eyes of people and make those who still believe in the Warren Commission report have a better understanding of why it is absurd and extremely naive for anybody to believe the Warren Commission report.
I agree. Thank you so much. We do have a link up for
Thank
the
you.
Book, The JFK Assassination Dissected, an analysis by forensic pathologist Cyril Wecht, is available on today's program guide. Dr. Wecht, happy Thanksgiving to you and your family.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks.
All right. We are going to kick open the case files, and we're going to take an examination of our own into dumb crimes and stupid criminals.
It's Crayon News Storytime.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, it's time now for Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. I want to make a quick mention, since we just came off of talking about the assassination of President Kennedy, I do have a documentary, a shock doc, that's coming out this Friday on Discovery Plus. It's called A Demon in the White House. And no, it's not about our past or our recent present president. This is about the spiritualist aspect, the haunting of the White House, how some of these ghosts may have found their way in. It's an interesting story and look at that element, and could dark influences have been accidentally invited into the White House? I hope you'll check that out. A Demon in the White House comes out this Friday, the 26th, on Discovery Plus. Tim Dennis, as I mentioned at the start of the show, is out. Our thoughts and prayers are with him as he is battling COVID. Please do me a favor, do not blow up his social media or email messages, text messages, whatever. He is just needs some downtime to recoup and take care of himself. So please show respect and time. That's why he hasn't been big to announce this, as he loves the love you guys give him and the attention, but he just does not want to feel the need to respond to everybody and answer questions. He feels miserable. So just please bear that in mind, and hopefully he'll be back up and running and on Darkness Radio here soon and True Crime Tuesday. I've got with me tonight my wife, the beautiful and talented Winnie Schrader. She is here to kind of go over dumb crimes, stupid criminals with me.
Hello.
We've got some stories. First of all, I want to do some follow-up stories.
Okay.
These aren't dumb crimes, stupid criminals so much, but they're follow-up angles to stories that we've done in the past on the program. Big news this week. Zodiac killer may be unmasked as cold case team finds a gold mine of new evidence.
Mm.
Yeah, a team of specialists who investigate cold cases and claims to have identified the Zodiac killer earlier this year released a statement that a trove of evidence has been discovered linked to the deceased suspect Gary Francis Post, or Posty. When the casebreakers approached officials about a new Zodiac suspect last spring, five police and state agencies would not cooperate. The specialist said in a statement on Saturday. But last week, the man who runs the 10-year-old cold case team, Thomas J. Colbert, or Colbert, I'm not sure if he's the fancy version or the Americanized version, received a tip from his longtime sources in the remote town of deceased Gary Francis Post that they had verified the existence of an evidentiary gold mine. The group says that prior to his death, Post had given away weapons and bullets that could provide key evidence in the case. Old associates of the house painter alleged serial killer claim that a few years prior to Post's death in 2018, at the age of 80, he had quietly given away his weapons, pistol parts, gunpowder, bullets, and shell casings, more than 1,000 involving 25 different calibers to his favorite locals. That's what the casebreaker said. And most of these peculiar gifts have remained in basements and closets untouched ever since.
Hmm.
The casebreakers added that it took Thomas J. Colbert, the head of the cold case team investigating the killing, several hours to cautiously box up the historic hall and forward it to the team's members standing by at a private forensics lab in three states. Now, in October, the Case Breakers announced they identified Post, who passed away in 2018 as the Zodiac Killer, believed responsible for at least five murders that occurred in 1968 and 1969 in the San Francisco area. Unlike most serial killers, the Zodiac taunted authorities with complex ciphers and letters sent to newspapers and law enforcement. The slayings have spawned books, movies, and documentaries in the years since, and amateur and professional sleuths have pored over the case in an effort to unmask the killer. Now, across years of digging, the team uncovered new forensic evidence and photos from Post's darkroom. One image features scars on the forehead of Post that match scars on the sketch of the Zodiac, according to the team. The day after the Case Breakers revealed the information, the Federal Bureau of Investigation announced that the case is still open. The FBI's investigation into the Zodiac Killer remains open and unsolved, said FBI Fox News. Due to the ongoing nature of the investigation and out of respect for the victims and their families, we will not be providing further comment at this time.
Well, I mean, there's been so many theories with the Zodiac Killer, but I mean, this guy, he looks like he fits the bill. And what an odd thing, though, to give to people, like parts of guns.
Well, he's like, clearing out his collection. That I get. Maybe, you know, you're older, there's nobody, you're just giving them to friends and relatives, but it's a great way to disperse the evidence.
Well, yeah, because, like, you always hear about the killer, like, tossing the gun in the river or, you know, just give that stuff.
This guy seems like the kind of guy that would have kept his weapons.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, he must. He had to give them an alternative motive to give those away to people, you know, instead of just hide them. I don't know. That's a strange thing to do, but.
Well, and over all these years, it would have been easy enough to dissolve or grind down these guns or just find other ways to get rid of them.
Yeah, because back then they didn't have the ballistic science that they have now. So, like, he could have bored out a lot of those barrels of the guns so they wouldn't match any type of bullet. I don't know. It's
Or he could drive from San Francisco to Texas and throw them in a lake somewhere in Texas, or fly, you know, out to Florida and drop them in the lake with a gator. Just so, you know, because nobody in Florida would expect the gun you find might be tied to the serial killers in San Francisco.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless, of course, there's like a, I don't know, maybe there's like a giant database of ballistics issues, so if a gun does show up and they show it, they can go, oh my God, this is the gun, you know, I don't know. So here's another interesting update to one of the cases that we've covered on the show. The FBI has searched a New Jersey former landfill for the body of Jimmy Hoffa. In the body of long-missing Teamsters Union boss, is the body of long-missing Teamsters Union boss Jimmy Hoffa really to be found, stuck in the dirt somewhere near the swamps of Jersey? Well, the FBI confirmed to NBC News that in October, it searched a site of a former landfill in northern New Jersey for Hoffa's body, apparently based on a tip from the son of the landfill business partner who claimed to have buried him. Now, the search for Hoffa in Jersey City underneath a heavily traveled bridge is just the latest over decades in what has been one of law enforcement's wildest goose chases, with multiple location searches over the years. Most of these searches occurred in Michigan, where Hoffa was last seen in 1975, years after he had control of what had been the largest union in the United States and served a prison stint for jury tampering, mail and wire fraud, and conspiracy. One notorious tip, which did not lead to a search, was that Hoffa was buried in the concrete foundation of the old Giants Stadium in New Jersey in the Meadowlands. In 2019, Martin Scorsese filmed The Irishman, itself based on the nonfiction book I Heard You Paint Houses, details the disputed claim by purported mafia hitman and Teamsters official Frank Sheeran that he, in fact, killed Hoffa, who was later cremated. The latest search was first reported Thursday by the New York Times. The investigative reporter Dan Moldella, originally wrote about the tip that led to the search. Last month, the FBI obtained a search warrant to conduct a site survey underneath the Pulaski Skyway, FBI spokesperson Mara Schneider from the Detroit field office told NBC News. Now, on October 25th and 26th, FBI personnel from the Newark and Detroit field offices completed the survey, and that data is currently being analyzed, which means they found something.
Well, yeah, they must have.
Right? Of course, it is New Jersey. And they might have to figure out which body they're looking at.
I know, right? We've seen The Sopranos.
Yeah, because the affidavit in support of the search warrant was sealed by the court, we are unable to provide any additional information. News of the search came the same week as the International Brotherhood of Teamsters elected Sean O'Brien as its general president, replacing Hoffa's son, James Hoffa, who has served that role for 22 years, the younger Hoffa did not seek re-election. The tip about his father's body purported whereabouts came from Frank Coppola, the son of former landfill business partner Paul Coppola. Now, Paul Coppola, according to Modilla's account, as he approached death in 2008, told Frank that he buried Hoffa's body in a 55-gallon steel drum after the labor leader vanished in 1975 amid a fallout with the New Jersey Mafia chieftain Anthony Tony Pro Provenzano. Now, unidentified people brought Hoffa's body back to the site, Frank later wrote in a summary of what his father told him. Frank Coppola died in 2020. Modilla told the Times that the FBI contacted him about Frank's claims letter later that year after he wrote about them. The Times reported that records show that the FBI received tips over the years, including in 1975, that Hoffa was buried in a Jersey City landfill. An earlier search based on those tips, though, uncovered nothing. So it'll be interesting to see if this has panned out much more than they originally thought.
Yeah, I wonder if Geraldo's going to do the reveal.
Good God, I hope not. Listen, we made the news. Mm-hmm. Minnesota.
Oh, no.
Minnesota's in the news, and we're putting our foot down. We're stomping out crime in Anoka County. Are you ready for this?
Yes, I am.
Right? Gang violence, drugs, car thieves, people being murdered. That's not our focus in Anoka. That. No. Drawing a hopscotch board on a sidewalk or a street in Anoka? Now against the law.
Oh, God.
There will be no hopscotching in the town of Anoka. The ramifications of a new ordinance governing displays on city property recently passed by the city council. So city property, would that be schools? So no more hopscotch at schools?
I guess not. Yeah, because that would be considered public property.
Listen, Susie, you're going in for a hard time.
I just wanted to play hopscotch.
The ordinance regulates flags, murals, memorials, banners, and even chalk displayed on buildings, light posts, flagpoles, streets and sidewalks, parks, and other infrastructure. It's designed to allow the city to protect and maintain aesthetics of city-owned property. Only items that illustrate governmental expression of the city of Anoka will be allowed. Displays, memorials, or artwork commissioned or solicited and approved by the city, and those that celebrate and portray Anoka in a positive fashion, those are also okay. But no fucking hopscotch.
Okay, so the only signs you can put up, Anoka, the Halloween capital of the world. That's
or yay,
it.
We love Anoka. So don't even think you're going to write hopscotch, yay Anoka, because they're going to put you away for that too.
Ugh.
Governmental expression, for example, includes the American flag, flags representing the branches of the U.S. military, City of Anoka banners commemorating holidays, seasons, or celebrations, and temporary signs for city events and activities. The ordinance allows the city to change the backlighting of the city logo on Highway 10 Bridge. Boy, they're really anal about this.
Well, they make
Bob, I think we ought to change it from purple to orange because we are the Halloween capital.
Well,
anybody else second that? I do!
It's like they're making it sound like these kids are running rampant around the city of Anoka with chalk.
The hopscotch pandemic is crazy in Anoka. You don't want to get involved because here's what I hear. When you cross that line between the Bloods and Crips hopscotch, you don't want, you're looking for a drive-by Super Bowling.
Yeah, right?
He's going to peg you hard with a Super Bowl, yo. Oh, my God. The issue of chalk art dominated the discussion.
Really?
At November 1st meeting, where the ordinance was passed 4-1. One guy's like a lone holdout. No, hopscotch will remain in Anoka. No way, we're pulling it out. Council member Eric Skoguist, who cast the dissenting vote. Thank you, Eric. Thank you for being the lone voice of reason in Anoka, said he agreed with 95% of the ordinance, but was concerned about its far-reaching impact. Yeah, my daughters love the hopscotch, eh? I don't want to make it illegal for a kid to draw on the sidewalk with chalk, which is what we are saying, he said. I'm not okay with that.
Yeah, I agree with him. That's
how soon till we see like a cop shooting some kid because he's drawn like a mural of Pokemon on the sidewalk.
Pikachu on the sidewalk.
Council members asked City Attorney Scott Baumgartner for advice in crafting the ordinance, wondering if there's room to allow certain types of chalk art, such as hopscotch boards. No way. It looks like an erect penis on our sidewalk, and I won't be having it.
God.
Baumgartner advised adopting an all or none approach.
It's all or nothing.
Yeah, but that's like, it's sidewalk chalk.
Don't they have anything better to do in the city?
The sidewalk chalk industry is collapsing under the weight of this.
Oh.
Oh my God. Upon Baumgartner's advice, the city council voted to ban all chalk on city property, even children's sidewalk drawings. This is crazy. I say we do a rally and we go and just bring every kid from Anoka into the middle of town and just start drawing on sidewalks. What are they going to do?
Yeah,
open fire with rubber bullets? Mace a bunch of 5 and 6 year olds?
If you have chalk, they're just going to bust out the hoses and wash it off. And then you're going to have a many disappointed
there might be some
children.
Tasing
because of chalk.
Yeah. Rice said it's unfortunate the city needs an ordinance like this, but it protects the integrity of the city and our community and our citizens and all from that nonsense.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, the nonsense that is hopscotch.
And they wonder why kids just stick on tablets and phones.
Here's the funny thing.
They're taking everything away.
We're taking away hopscotch, but tetherball. A hard plastic or leather ball on a rope that you can bash into your friend's face. That remains safe.
Oh, I've got a tetherball to the face. It's not fun.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy. But it doesn't stop there in the Minnesota shenanigans. We're going to Hopkins for our next story.
Okay.
Great, Scott. Hopkins police announced Tuesday the completion of an extended investigation and subsequent charges for financial exploitation of a vulnerable adult. Police say Cynthia Julie Evans, age 26, has been charged with 2 felony counts of financial exploitation of a vulnerable adult and 2 counts of theft by swindle.
Okay.
What are you in for? Swindling. Evans has been accused of swindling at least $130,000 from 2 victims, promising to lift curses as a self-proclaimed psychic and spiritual advisor. Police say medical records revealed both victims were diagnosed with mental health disorders. In the first criminal complaint, the victim, 30-year-old man, says Evans told him she worked with energies and could help him achieve his relationship and employment goals. He says Evans told him that he'd been cursed at conception and would need to buy a candle for each year he was born at $100 each to break the curse. Candles he paid for but never received. You think she couldn't have just gone out and bought $300 like dollar candles?
Yeah, right. You could have gone to the dollar store and gotten some candles.
Yeah, I mean, he paid $100 per candle per year for 30 years.
Ugh.
Just give him $30 store candles. The complaint says that she also had the money buy a $14,000 Rolex to give to her to help her end the curse. You have to understand, in order to remove the curse, I need to be on time. Please to give to me the Rolex watch. I don't know what accent that is. I'm trying to be as nondescript with that accent so I don't piss off any religions or ethnicities. The criminal complaint says that the money was taken from the victim's mother's retirement account.
Aww.
She had him open up a $10,000 line of credit, which she claimed she needed for ongoing spiritual work. Good God. In total, between approximately June 3rd of 2018 and August 27th, 2020, so just about 2 years, a little change, police say Evans obtained approximately $87,886.61 in money or other property.
Wow.
Police say the second victim was a 64-year-old woman who fell into the same trap as the first victim. She paid out more than $48,575.44 for unfulfilled promises. Boy, could we sue the kids for all the unfulfilled promises and the money I've spent to them? Oh, I swear, Dad, if you just get us this dog, we'll clean up after it. We'll love it. We'll feed it. We'll take it out for walks. I have a lot of money these little bastards owe me.
Right?
Unfulfilled promises.
Yeah.
$5,000 of that from a life insurance policy, which police say Evans encouraged the woman to do. The victim, who had cancer, says Evans told her the cancer would return if she didn't follow the instructions.
Oh, gosh. That's horrible.
Hopkins police say they believe there could be more victims out there that have gone unreported. Evans is currently not in custody and will have her first appearance in court next month. If convicted, she faces up to 80 years in prison.
Good, and I hope she gets all 80 years.
Cynthia Julie Evans, if you are a victim of her in Hopkins and you've been swindled of money or Rolex watches, make sure that you contact the Hopkins Police Department.
Yeah,
that's obscene.
And it's so sad that people take advantage of people like that, you know, that have mental issues or elderly people that are just very vulnerable and, ugh, gross. I hope she gets put away for a long, long time.
Tiger King's Carol Baskin responds to claims that husband Don Lewis may be alive. How much does this guy hate Carol Baskin?
I don't know.
But he's been hiding for, what, like 20 years in Brazil?
Yeah.
Or wherever the hell he ended up. A key element regarding the mysterious disappearance of Carol Baskin's husband, Don Lewis, was uncovered in Tiger King 2. Now we get to find out what she had to say about it. Carol Baskin has some thoughts about a claim made in Tiger King 2 that her missing husband, Florida millionaire Don Lewis, may be alive. The Florida millionaire disappeared in 1997 and was legally declared dead in 2002. On the hit 2020 Netflix docuseries Tiger King, Oklahoma zookeeper Joe Exotic accused Baskin, a big cat rescue activist, of killing her husband, who told her he wanted a divorce. While she has denied involvement in this disappearance, police have deemed her a high-profile person of interest in the case. On the recently released Tiger King 2 series, a document the show identifies as being from the Department of Homeland Security states that Don is currently alive and well in Costa Rica. In an interview with British TV network ITV show This Morning, which aired on Thursday, November 18th, Baskin said the letter was one of the really exciting things that came out of Tiger King 2. Baskin added that this means this had to have happened after 2002 because Homeland Security wasn't even around until 2002, referring to the Homeland Security Act, of course, that took place after 9/11. They said that my husband Don Lewis is alive and well in Costa Rica, she said, and yet all this hay has been made about me having something to do with his disappearance when Homeland Security has known where he is at least since back then.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't they releasing that? This is fraud.
I don't know. I did watch the second season of Tiger King, and there
look
were...
Look how shameful you look.
I am. It's
like when I caught you
pleasure.
Eating cake in the bathtub by yourself crying.
That is kind of how I feel watching Tiger King. It's a guilty pleasure that I don't... I'm kind of shameful to like, but it was very convoluted because, like, some people were saying that, yeah, I've been in contact with Don Lewis in Costa Rica, and I've been helping him do this and this and this.
He's building Jurassic Park there.
I think that's what his plan was, because he wanted to move all the cats. I mean, he wanted to take everything that he had at the place in Florida.
All those cool cats and kitties.
Yeah, but then there's, like... he was a gun enthusiast. He had, like, a lot of guns, and he was just gung-ho about it and loved his collection. And one of his, like, kind of right-hand dudes that he always had around, his friend that helped him out, Carol gave him all the guns. But then he said Don gave him the guns. But then it went back to Carol giving him the guns. Like, this was right when he went missing. Like, why have all of a sudden all of his stuff is going to this guy? I don't know. It's just very... weird, and you can't tell who's telling the truth. I mean, if Don Lewis is alive in Costa Rica, God bless him. He's far away from this hot mess of Tiger King, and I don't blame him for hiding out there.
Do you think he's shaking his fist at Joe Exotic right now, going, that bastard, they put me on the scent now because now they're going to try to prove I'm alive.
Yeah.
This guy would have left me alone. The Department of Homeland Security had no immediate response when reached by E! News, the organization. Now, it's hard to believe that Homeland Security is not answering to E! News. The organization has not commented publicly to the claims made in Tiger King 2 or to remarks by Baskin, who was not involved in the making of the sequel series and even sued Netflix for using footage of her in it. According to People, the streaming service and production company Royal Good Productions had said in court documents that contracts Baskin signed permits them to use previously shot footage of her in future projects. Mm-hmm. Be aware of that, folks. Anybody that wants to get into reality TV, any TV, really, but reality is the biggest culprit, you basically sign away everything and anything. So when you're not talking be careful of everything you say, because mm-hmm. any of that can be used. They own the rights to all of the recorded photographic and video things, and they could do an entire new series just on Carol Baskin, and she doesn't have to sign off on it because she already gave over her rights for everything that they filmed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like this second season of Tiger King is very much like Making a Murderer. Now it's making Joe Exotic look a little more innocent than we all thought he was. So
on the second, speak for yourself. I've always believed in Joey E. On the second episode of Tiger King 2, Lewis attorney Joseph Fritz said that after the first season was released in early 2020, a police detective called him and got mad at me and slipped up and told me there was federal reports of Lewis alive and well in Costa Rica that he had to overcome. Fritz said a friend who worked in federal law enforcement helped locate more information on him. The document attributed to Homeland Security is then displayed. Parts are blacked out and no data is shown. The document states that Lewis owns property in Costa Rica and has traveled regularly. That Baskin filed a missing persons report with the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office in Tampa in August of 1997, stating that her husband had disappeared. The document also states that a van owned by Don Lewis was located at Pilot County Estate in Pasco County, Florida. Detectives found no evidence of foul play. Hillsborough South SO detectives learned that Lewis had recently purchased a $1.5 million life insurance policy. See, there's fraud right there. And if it got paid out in 2002 to Carol,
yep.
I don't know if she'd be on the hook, but Don would be.
I don't know. It's very weird because, like, even his, like, life insurance documents that were supposedly notarized by, like, his business partner, I can't remember her name off the top, she said those documents were forged. So, I don't know. It seems like there's so many different levels of deception and who's telling the truth. And it was weird because, like, Don Lewis's signature on every document was the exact same. So they were saying that Carol Baskin took his signature, traced it, and put it on each of these documents. So, I don't
know. Lewis's family is offering a private $100,000 reward for tips that would lead to finding out what happened to him. They have advertised it on billboards and even in an ad that aired in the fall of 2020 during Dancing with the Stars when Baskin competed on the show.
Yep.
So, good grief. What a train wreck.
It is. It's kind of, who did it? Is he alive? Who knows? I have a feeling there's going to be another season, and we'll find out.
If I send you this story, can you play this audio?
I can try.
Okay. Let me see if I can get this link, because this, you got to hear this guy. It's just amazing to me. Let me try to copy and paste this, so not savvy when it comes to all this bouncing around on the interwebs. Yeah, because this is a funny story. Terminally ill man arrested for mooning a speeding camera. And there's actual audio of this guy as he's being busted. But let me see if I get this to you. Hold on. There's the link. I'm going to read the story and then we'll see if you can fire it off. Terminally ill man arrested for mooning a speed camera, gobsmacked by a Banksy mural. He had written on his bucket list how he wanted to bear all and brazenly went through with it. A terminally ill man, collared by cops for mooning at a speed camera, pardon me, has claimed graffiti artist Banksy spray painted a wall in his honor. Daryl Mecom is convinced mysterious artwork, which is now popped up in Kidderminster, belongs to the infamous street painter. The 55-year-old received an anonymous tip that a cheeky mural featuring Bart Simpson flashing his bum at two police officers had been etched across a wall for him. It comes after six cops raided the retired university lecturer's home following reports he mooned behind a van in Kidderminster. Six cops raided this guy's home for mooning a camera. In England. This is where there's, I think they call them the Page Six girls, where in the newspaper there's topless women and they get away with that on TV. And this guy mooned a camera. The father of three had written on his bucket list how he wanted to bear all at a speed camera and brazenly went through with it. Although unconfirmed, Mr. Mecom has said that he is 100% sure the mural is the latest addition to Banksy's satirical street art collection. The self-proclaimed prankster from Worcester said, "I'm utterly speechless. It's really amazing. All I was doing was having a bit of fun." And it really does look like a Banksy painting.
Yeah, it does.
That's crazy how it looks like a Banksy painting of Bart Simpson dropping his trousers and two police with batons and
police shields are beating, are about to beat him with it. I can only assume it's Banksy. It's very much along the lines of Banksy. How many people get this opportunity? The fact that somebody can make a statement out of a piece of art like this is incredible. I think it must have struck a chord with Banksy. He is a clear supporter of the little man, and that's exactly what's been done here. It really depicts the situation well. The former Russell Hall Hospital A&E nurse said, "It really does stick the fingers up at all the police officers, and I hope that they learn their lesson from this." Let's go ahead and play that audio.
All right, here we go.
Sarah, come and tell him.
He can't
tell him that. Turn me.
Yeah. Oh, no. Jasmine.
I won't be able to breathe like this. I'm terminally ill with multiple system
action. Listen, we'll stand you up. So just listen to the officers.
You're under arrest. And
this is ridiculous.
And exposure. And
I mooned a speed camera. I mooned a speed camera.
I mooned a speed camera.
Yeah, I'm quite happy to say that because it was one off my bucket list. Okay. I've just been diagnosed on the 8th, on the 19th of October with multiple system atrophy. I'm terminally ill. I've got a very short time to live. And it was one off my bucket list. Haven't you ever wanted to moon a speed camera?
No.
Well, I did.
No.
There's some damage to the door, unfortunately. It might need fixing.
I've got Parkinson's disease, heart failure, stage 3 kidney disease. Okay. I'm very asthmatic and I've also got multi-system atrophy.
We'll try and get you
up,
but you've got to listen to the officers.
All right.
Hi, my name's Daryl Mee.
Pull it down. I just moonied a speed. Haven't you ever wanted to moony a speed camera? No.
Yeah, I know, right? And I just love how that's, like, on his bucket list.
Yeah.
And it's just like, hey.
The most innocuous thing, right? It's just, you're mooning a camera. He didn't star him, right?
No.
Which is showing the junk.
Yeah.
He just gave him a little wink from the old brown eye, and they're arresting him. Indecent exposure. I'm really good. Dave Schrader, defense attorney at law, wants to step in on this case, but I don't think I can practice over in England.
No, you have to have a license over there.
I don't have a license here. It doesn't stop me from offering. Good God. And that he's got all of these diseases. Mr. Mecom has Parkinson's disease, heart and kidney failure problems, as well as a rare disorder, multiple system atrophy. He insists he didn't break the law when he wiggled his bare bum and believes police action was disproportionate to the crime. The married man received a Facebook message from a woman claiming to represent an international street artist who wanted to create a comical piece in response to the arrest. My God.
I say let him have his fun. And they had like 20 cops on him.
Yeah, six cops. And they're pinning him to the ground. This guy's like an old, doddering. I mean, he's a big guy, but still, it's like they're kneeling on his legs, holding his ankles down. Is this guy that big a threat?
Maybe they don't want to see
his bum.
Maybe they're afraid he was going to pull his pants down again.
He's going to show us his buttocks.
I know, right?
Oh, my God. He says, "For however long you have left on Earth, I wish that it is filled with love and playfulness and that you complete your bucket list." A van driver reported Mr. Mecom to West Mercia Police for indecent exposure on Friday, November 5th. Oh, God. What a bunch of prudish pricks.
I'm kind of interested, though, what else is on his bucket list.
I don't know, like eating all of the Oreos in one bag. I mean, it just like seems very bland. Great, Scott. I love this headline. Vigilante known as the Stockton Batman claims he apprehended a double murder suspect. Now check this out. A vigilante boasts nabbing hundreds of bad guys from suspected arsonists, to shoplifters. The vigilante known as the Stockton Batman appears to have added yet another notch to his utility belt. The mysterious figure who claims to have nabbed hundreds of criminals in the mid-California city may have made his biggest collar yet with the apprehension of a double murder suspect. On November 16th, a video posted by local news site 209 Times, narrated by the presumed... Words is tough. On November 16th, we'll do this in bite-sized morsels, a video posted by local news site 209 Times, narrated by the presumably caped crusader himself, shows the moment the blood-covered suspect is taken into custody in Salus Park. So I was doing my own investigation this morning. The disappointingly non-gravel-voiced narrator explains in the video, a double homicide came over the scanner right after I dropped the kids off to school, so I checked it out, as one is wont to do.
Mm-hmm.
I've dropped the kids off. I'm going to go try to apprehend a double murder suspect. Displaying his skills as the world's other greatest detective, Stockton Batman describes how he found suspicious items, like clothing in the bathroom trash can, while his wife found something heavy in the trash can of the woman's bathroom. And then we see this guy wobbling with blood on him, and he's acting real funny and suspicious about what's going on. In a video titled, Bruce Wayne Detains Possible Double Homicide Suspect in Lodi, Stockton Batman reveals he recognized the transient from the Rogues Gallery because he used to pick up cigarette butts in front of his yard. Noticing possible knife wounds to his leg and hands, Stockton Batman said he immediately called police, detaining the suspect until officers arrived. According to Lodi police, on the morning of November 16th, they received reports of two stabbing victims lying near the railroad tracks north of Harney Lane. They arrived and found a 16-year-old female and a 17-year-old male both dead. Shortly afterward, they said they received reports of a possible third stabbing victim at Salis Park. There they found 29-year-old Randall Allenbaugh, who they quickly determined was the suspect responsible for the double homicide. They said the two victims and the suspect all knew each other. They did not, however, credit Stockton Batman. Two Fab has reached out to him for comment. The coroner's office later identified the victims as 17-year-old Skylar McConnell and 16-year-old Chimera Skaggs, according to KTXL. Allenbaugh appeared in the court on Thursday, arraigned on two charges of homicide. He was denied bail by the judge. Now, according to the outlet, Allenbaugh served in the Army as an infantryman from October 2011 to November 2013, holding the rank of private. He did not have any deployments. Police have yet to reveal a motive. Stockton Batman, meanwhile, vanished into the night. His work done. His identity still a mystery.
Mm.
In July of 2018, CBS 13 scored an interview with the enigmatic vigilante right after he busted someone allegedly smoking crystal meth outside a busy 99-cent dollar store. This is my town. Put out the crack.
Oh.
They're criminals into which point they're committing crimes in front of my eyes, he said. I grew up in Stockton and things weren't always this bad when I was a child, he scowled. I can run around and play. While Stockton residents were glad of the extra layer of protection, police pointed out that although citizens' arrests are perfectly legal in California, they prefer the public to just call 911 and let them handle it. No.
So, if he did the interview, did they kind of do that silhouette thing of him?
Well, in the image, there's the silhouette of Batman.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you mean like when they interviewed him, was he like in the background? And yes, I stopped the $1.99 coke addicts. A scary moment happened this Monday night on WWE. Seth Rollins attacked by a fervent fan during the Raw taping. And the wrestler needed droves of security to help get the guy off of him. It all went down just seconds after the superstar had beaten Finn Balor in the ring at Barclays Center in New York, when a man left his seat, jumped some railing, and speared Rollins while the 35-year-old was on his way back to the locker room. Video shot by fans standing next to the altercation is wild. The man absolutely rocked Rollins, taking him to the ground in a violent fashion. Rollins was able to fight back long enough for WWE refs and security to help him, and fortunately, Seth was able to wriggle free and avoid any serious injury. WWE officials confirmed the attack was not fake, and that they were working with law enforcement to make sure the man will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. WWE takes the safety of its performers very seriously. I was watching a special about Roddy Piper,
mm-hmm.
who was one of my favorite WWE wrestlers back in the day. And in his leather jacket he wore, he had, I think it was chainmail,
mm-hmm.
inside of it because he had been stabbed multiple times by angry fans because he played the heel.
Yeah. It's amazing how...
For God's sakes, if you're listening to the show and you watch wrestling, fucking relax.
Right?
It's entertainment. There's good guys and bad guys. You don't stab an actor on screen because that's what scares me, is that thin line. People can't separate an actor from the role they play.
Yeah.
Or these characters in wrestling. Now, having talked to Chris Jericho, I said, what do you do if you're in the ring and somebody tries to get you? He goes, we kick the shit out of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You enter their ring, I guess they can just pound the living snot out of you.
Well, yeah, it's self-defense, especially if they have, if they're wielding a weapon like with Pipe or getting stabbed. Yeah, I know wrestling fans, they're very passionate people and they get really involved.
Because you're excited about it, but they're still characters.
And I think a lot of wrestling fans can't
separate the two. I'm not lumping all wrestling fans into one. That's my wife, so attack her.
Well, no. I'm just saying that, you know, they're very passionate.
Oh, my God, D-Trader just told people to attack his wife. He's going to prison for
I'm
going
to have to get chains in my coat.
Yeah, right? All right, here we go. This I understand. A pastor was tackled by a father who allegedly witnessed him grope his 9-year-old son at a bus stop. This guy's face is up.
In
Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, a 9-year-old boy was touched inappropriately by a 33-year-old Michael Coghill while waiting for his bus for school. According to the police report from the Oklahoma City Police Department, the guy touched him on the back, and he didn't like the way that it made him feel. In response to the allegations, the father took matters into his own hands. After being made aware of the situation, the boy's father decided to conduct his own stakeout. Yesterday, our adult that was made aware of the situation actually stopped, retrieved a recording device, monitored at the bus stop, observed and viewed the suspect run past the bus stop, stop, come back, and then touch the juvenile, Oklahoma Police Sergeant Dylan Quirk told WKFO, or KFOR, the four. Four at ten. Is that
cool?
Upon
confusing.
Identifying the man, the father ran up and tackled the minister to the ground, fracturing his skull, cracking an eye socket, and leaving scratches and bruises all over his face. The police report also said that the man has jogged past the bus stop multiple times and that he seems to know when the kids would arrive every day. Now, what I don't get is just running up and kind of running your hand up somebody's back.
Yeah.
I mean, that's weird, but is it tackle them, crush their face, maybe video? I don't know. I don't know if there's a second touching that they're not talking about here, that they're not touching on.
Yeah.
Because I would maybe have filmed it and then turned it over to the police, right? I'm saying that as a father, a very protective father.
Yeah.
But if my daughter or son is telling me this and I watch a guy run up and junk handle him.
Yeah, that's different.
I'm with my car. He's done.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
The police report also said that the man has jogged past multiple times. He seems to know when the kids would arrive. Lisa Ward, a witness whose children also wait at the same bus stop every day, shared her disgust with News 9. There's hardly any words that are camera appropriate. It's just sickening, she said. Where do they just come out of the woodwork and prey on children? And that he knew the time he would be there every day. That was the hardest part, the most disgusting part. She admitted that she had seen him jogging in the area before and that he was bloodied upon entering the police vehicle after being tackled to the ground. He was in the cop car bloody. It was just gut-wrenching knowing he was even in the cop car across the street. Considering he has allegedly done this multiple times, police are urging anyone with information to come forward. If we have more victims, we encourage them. If they know something, say something. Come forward, Quirk said. Coghill is facing a count of lewd, indecent acts to a child and is being held by Oklahoma City Police on a $50,000 bond. Now, they're not, it said it, he ran his hand up his back.
Yeah, but then he said that he filmed and recorded stuff, but they didn't really elaborate, like,
what the inappropriate touching is. Yeah.
Yeah, they just said that he touched his back and the child didn't like that touch.
Lake Homa Church of Christ released this statement. We are heartbroken to learn of the incident that occurred yesterday morning involving Mike Coghill, our discipleship minister, and we were shocked to learn this news through social media today. Mike has a clean background check, and we have received no reports or claims against him during his tenure at Lake Homa. We will be fully cooperating with law enforcement as needed. Our hearts go out to the family and child involved in the incident. And it goes on from there. Very strange. You know what I'm hoping is that this isn't one of those times when, like, when he was jogging by, he'd seen this kid before and the kid was crying and he stopped by and what's wrong and the kid told him. And every now and again, he stops by to check on the kid and just kind of pats his back. And he's like, you know, I hope it's not going to turn out to be one of those things.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, Jake, how you doing? But now he's been told in school, don't let people touch you. And to him, all of a sudden, he feels uncomfortable because of this touch. You know, I hope it's not something like that.
Yeah.
You know, because you don't want to see a guy's life ruined over a misinterpretation, and as a youth pastor, maybe that's what he was doing. But again, this father had to have seen something.
Well, yeah, for him to go ballistic like that on him, something had to have happened. Because I can't just imagine if I saw somebody touch the back of one of my children, and if it seemed a little off, I'd be like, you know, okay, that's a little weird.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I might joke around and go, hey, probably shouldn't be touching kids. The clergy has enough problems with that, right? Trying to joke about it. Mm-hmm. But give that guy the eye, the old stink corner eye.
Like, I'm watching you. Yeah.
Well, this is a week of... Payback is a bitch.
Okay.
That was a case of instant justice, and so is this. Instant justice. I can't remember what I used to call it. Was it instant justice? Instant something. It's been a while.
Swift justice.
Swift justice. Swift justice. Swift justice. That's right. Here's another case where a mom smacks a teen daughter's peeping Tom with a bat. Oklahoma cop said, I had to hit him. A quick-thinking mother was forced to use a baseball bat to prevent a peeping Tom from entering her daughter's bedroom, Oklahoma cops say. It led to injuries and subsequent charges for Corey McMichael, who was found by police with his pants down wearing an open jacket outside of a Dell City home, police said in an incident report. Officers were dispatched to an Oklahoma City area apartment on November 6th when the mother said she called in 911 that a man was trying to break into their home. He had his clothes off. He had a trench coat on, and he was outside of my building, the woman said in the 911 call. He was trying to come through my daughter's window, too. He was trying to crawl through.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just make that clear, not come through.
Crawl through. Right.
Police later learned that McMichael, 46, unsuccessfully tried to open the front door, the mother told police, according to an incident report. When the noise stopped, the mom ran to her vehicle to retrieve a baseball bat. She had to go outside to get the baseball bat?
Apparently so.
Hmm. She then saw McMichael at her daughter's bedroom window with his pants down, exposing his genitalia and trying to open the window. Bad things would happen. Oh, no. Such bad things would happen. The woman struck the man multiple times with the baseball bat until he got away from the window, according to the incident report. No, no, I'm just a little shaky right now, the woman told the dispatcher when asked if she needed medical attention, because I went out to my car and got my bat, and when I got it, I had to hit him with it.
That's right.
Goddamn right you do. McMichael suffered a broken wrist and also had some bumps and bruises, KWTW reported, in this case of swift justice, swift justice, swift justice. As he was in the emergency room, McMichael said, that bitch hit me with a bat for trying to get in a window.
What?
Like, that's his defense?
You're naked under a trench coat.
Trying
You're
to climb
normal.
Into a teenage girl's window. After he received medical treatment, McMichael was taken to Oklahoma County Detention Center. In addition to a peeping Tom charge, he's also accused of indecent exposure and burglary. Great Scott.
He's lucky that's all he got was a baseball bat.
Right. So we've got a dad so far. Mm-hmm. Steps up. We've got a mom steps up. This one, I love this headline. A 9-year-old girl in Florida was awarded by police after they say she fought off a robber to protect her mom, all caught on video. West Palm Beach police say Journey Nelson and her mother were shopping for groceries at Sabre Tropical Supermarket on November 2nd when a suspect tried to steal her mom's purse. We walked out of the store, and then I took a little glance at him, and then I looked back at the car, and then I opened my door, and the next thing I know, I saw him running towards my mom, Journey said Sunday on Fox and Friends. Police say that while Journey's mother was loading groceries into her car, the suspect rushed up on her and began to violently pull at her purse before knocking her down. The suspect reportedly told the mother to let go of the purse or you're going to make me pop you while reaching for his waistband. Journey ran towards the encounter, punched the suspect on his head, and then chased him 4 houses down. The suspect initially got away, but was later identified as Demetrius Jackson and arrested 2 days later, police said. Journey was honored by the police department with a medal and certificate for her quick actions and courage. I wouldn't recommend that you confront an individual like that, but in the heat of the moment, things happen. I bet he was shocked when she kicked him right in the face because he definitely could tell on video that he was not expecting that. It's like that video of the guy that punches the kangaroo.
Oh, yeah.
The kangaroo's like, what the f*** just happened? This guy gets kicked right in a melon from a 9-year-old. Yeah, her actions were perfect timing in this particular situation, and I think she hit him pretty hard, Chief Frank Addery said. Jackson was charged with robbery and battery. It should also be terroristic threat.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to pop you, and reaching for his waistband, what did he have there?
I don't think
he wanted to show her the label from his Fruit of the Looms.
No, but I guess they can't really charge him unless he actually had some type of weapon. So he could have been just could have been a candy bar thing where he was going to yank a candy bar out and stick it in her back, pretending it to be a gun.
Kind of weird sex play.
That's been in a movie. That's been in a movie.
Our final story is here. The Floyd County SWAT team was called to Polk County on Monday afternoon to assist in a domestic altercation which saw a Cedartown man unload a gun. Reports said that an argument over trash bags between Justin Steve Hayes and his wife resulted in him firing a gun through her car. Police said that Hayes' wife told him that she was leaving their camper home. When she got home, their blind dog and attempted to exit the property in her car. Hayes then demanded that the dog stay with him. Every man needs a good blind dog, right?
Mm-hmm.
When she didn't allow that to happen, he fired a shot through her car. The woman then fled the scene and called 911 for help. Hayes then barricaded himself inside the camper, prompting SWAT to be called. After more than 3 hours, Hayes finally surrendered to authorities without any further incident. Hayes is charged with aggravated assault, reckless conduct, second-degree criminal damage to property, possession of a firearm during the commission of a crime, obstruction, and discharging a firearm during a public road. Over listen, you and I have had some stupid arguments.
Yes.
Well, mostly you. But it's we've had some stupid arguments, but never one that's made me want to pull a gun yet.
Yeah.
But over garbage bags?
I don't know. People just fight about the dumbest stuff. I mean, it's very juvenile. I mean,
Winifred, where is my lavender-scented kitchen garbage bags? I told you 13-gallon, not 10, not 11, not 9, 13-gallon. Is that what it went? How does it break down to the point where somebody's got to die?
I don't know. That's not something I would kill somebody over as a garbage bag. Frustrated,
hey,
yes.
Just for a friend asking, what exactly would you kill a husband over? I mean, if that, you know, just asking, curiosity.
If I told you, I'd have to kill you.
Oh, God. That's it. Well, thanks for tuning in and spending some time with us. Special thanks to Dr. Cyril Wecht. I know his segment's a little shorter than we're normally used to hearing, but I figured two things. All right. It's Kennedy's assassination. People are still fascinated by it. It's 58 years later. I didn't know what more could be said, but Dr. Cyril Wecht is 90 years old. That we got 30 minutes out of him, I was very appreciative for. Mm-hmm. The guy is quick as a whip, smart, eloquent, well-spoken, and said we could have 30 minutes. That's what we got. 30 minutes and an interesting perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that one of the leading forensic analysis guys in the world weighed in on this is, I think, an important element of the story.
Yes.
So special thanks to Dr. Cyril Wecht. I hope all of you out there listening have a very happy and healthy Thanksgiving. Be safe with one another, and I hope your life is filled with lots of love and laughter. We'll be back tomorrow for Darkness Radio with Supernatural News Parisher, the Headless Horseman edition. We have a guest that we will be talking with. I'm finalizing that. So we will have a brand new episode on Thanksgiving as well. So while you're cooking, you can listen to a little Darkness Radio. Nothing more cheery on Thanksgiving than listening to Darkness Radio.
That's right.
So thank you for tuning in. Keep Tim in your prayers and thoughts as he combats COVID-19. From Winnie, I'm Dave. You've been listening to the best in True Crime Talk Radio. This is True Crime Tuesday.